abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, March 10th, 2014. Just finished hosting the Peter Schiff Show. I'll be hosting again tomorrow. So check that out live from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern at schiffradio.com. I'll be taking your calls during that program, as always. Today, it's a potpourri show. We're going to talk about so-called austerity. Has it failed? Has it even been tried? But we're also going to talk about the war on drugs and Obamacare with our old friend Mark Thornton. Before we get to Mark, a quick reminder, make sure you subscribe to this program. Don't just catch a fugitive episode here and there. Make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere else you like to get your podcasts. You can find easy links to do that on the show site at tomwoodsradio.com. Right now, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the program once again Mark Thornton, senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, MISES.org is the website there. Mark is the author of The Economics of Prohibition, The Quotable Mises, and Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. He's also book review editor at the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. Mark Thornton, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be back on your show.
You know, Mark, I decided to have you on not because I have some scientific algorithm according to which I decide that it's been so long since I've had this or that guest, but just that every time I turn around, there's a new Mark Thornton article or blog post or video. So I thought we could just have a potpourri episode with Mark just talking about all the things he knows, all the things he's been writing about. So I want to start off, if you don't mind, on this general subject of austerity, because this never seems to go away. Because the conventional wisdom is that we have this tremendous economic downturn around the world, and that's certainly true, and that we've tried austerity, so-called, and it has failed. Because you stupid free market economists just don't understand how the world works, so now we're going to have to really try something different. We're going to have to try government spending and expansion of the money supply. We can't continue on this austere path that you so-called austerians have fastened us with. How do you answer that? First of all, how do you define austerity? Doesn't it really turn on that, right? How they define austerity and how we define austerity.
Well, of course it does. And many of your American listeners are probably really not familiar with this austerity issue. But if you go around the world, if you peek your head outside the United States, the media is on this story every day. And I'm talking about every country in Europe, some countries in Asia and elsewhere, where austerity budgets are the biggest issue of the day. And there's protests and there's demonstrations and there's riots in places like Portugal and Spain and Greece and elsewhere. And there's a rising volume of media around the world that are paying attention to this story. And in the United States, there's really not been much of an issue until last week when President Barack Obama released his budget and he said, from now on, we're not going to be doing this austerity thing anymore. And I pretty much jumped out of my chair when I heard him say that.
What?
Because, you know, austerity to you and me and people around the world listening to this show, austerity means you have to cut back on your budget. You may have, you know, lost a job or reduced your hours or something that where you don't have as much money coming in. And so austerity means you have to cut down on the money that's going out. And so you may have to, you know, get a new internet service that costs less or get a different cable plan that costs less, and you're going to be eating at home, fixing your own meals rather than eating out, and you're not going to go clothes shopping. And, you know, all these things means cutbacks on your standard of living. And, of course, the penultimate example of this is the monk who lives, you know, sparsely, has minimal primitive clothing, eats a very limited budget, there's no heat, there's no running water, and you're working all day long, or you're praying all day long. That's the highest example of austerity. And to think that the United States government has coming anywhere close to that is just patently absurd. And, you know, so if you look at the budgets here in the United States, what you find is that they've gone steadily upward after a huge major increase during the economic crisis. So rather than tightening our belt, we've basically bellied up to the buffet and have been eating constantly way beyond our budget. So we've been running $1 trillion annual budget deficits here in the United States. We've racked up $5 trillion during the first 4 years of the Obama administration on their budgets. And, you know, the rate of increase has tailed off recently in recent years, but it's still up 15% since Obama started, who took over the checkbook as president, and it's up 75%, a 75% increase in your budget from a decade ago. So we're spending huge amounts of more money, and we're running up this huge national debt. That's really the complete opposite of real austerity. And so it's laughable, basically, on the face of it. Now, of course, the reason that people are up in arms in Europe and elsewhere about austerity is because they're getting heavy doses of what I call IMF austerity, or the International Monetary Fund's idea, their economists' idea of what austerity is. And that's nothing like the Austrian or the man on the street approach to austerity. Under an austerity budget, basically, from the Austrian perspective, is that the politicians, the bureaucrats, and the government employees would get reduced wages, they'd get reduced benefits, they'd get reduced retirement benefits until the budget got in balance. And so you wouldn't cut back on government services, you'd just cut back on the pay of politicians, bureaucrats, and government employees and retirees. And so the public wouldn't, you know, lose their garbage collection. It wouldn't lose the government train. It would just, you know, all that stuff would continue. And it would be the public employees that would suffer, not the general citizenry. Now, in an IMF-type austerity budget, things are completely different. All the government employees and retirees get to keep all of their wages and benefits and retirements. And guess who suffers? Well, they increase taxes on the taxpayer, so everybody's ticked off at that because they've got less income and higher taxes. And also they cut government services to the people, so they stop running trains and they stop picking up the garbage and they, you know, close down the passport office, all the things that the government does that are necessary for the citizens of those particular countries under those particular systems. They start cutting that. So naturally everybody's pissed off. Everybody's demonstrating and rioting and protesting that type of IMF austerity, but that's not real Austrian style, Austrian economic style austerity, which works. And the Estonians and the Latvians have proven that that type of approach works very well. And now they have some of the fastest growing economies in the European world.
You know, Mark, it really does come down to the definition of terms, because I think that the other side is deliberately trying to obscure this important issue by using austerity in a way that runs counter to the way the man on the street would understand it. But this is part of a pattern. They do this all the time. So the free market is the cause of the financial crisis. Well, okay, then you point out that the Federal Reserve had something to do with that, and they'll come back and say, well, and I'm not kidding, they'll say, well, that's part of the free market. I mean, Richard Epstein is supposed to know better. And is it Epstein or was it Posner? No, I beg your pardon. I'll take that back. Not Richard Epstein. Richard Posner wrote a whole book on the financial crisis, And when he's asked about the Fed, and you say, look, the Fed is not part of the free market, he says, well, the Fed is part of modern capitalism. So now he's defining capitalism in a way that does not correspond to the man on the street definition of capitalism. You define words however you need to get your point of view to seem plausible. So now I want to shift gears, though. That's what you've been doing on the front, the austerity front. I want to move toward the drug issue. I mean, you've been involved in the drug question as a scholar. I don't mean as a user or a dealer, but you've been involved in the question for many years. I mean, you had a book, The Economics of Prohibition, many years ago, and you've continued to write and speak about it. But here's what I want to ask you. We can talk in a minute about the marijuana legalization that's been going on, but I want to ask you a basic fundamental economics 101 question about drug legalization. I've never gotten a good answer to this question. And that's this. If we legalize drugs, I think it seems to be the case that drug prices would go down. I think it would be more easy to get them. They would be available in greater supply, so their price would go down. Now, at the same time, people who favor legalization, I think, have wanted to soften this for the general public by saying, well, if we make drugs legal, you don't need to worry that everybody will be walking down the street with a heroin needle sticking out of his arm. Don't worry about that, because in fact, drug use will probably stay the same or even decline. But I don't understand that promise. Like, what other aspect of economics is there in which we say the price falls and the quantity demanded stays the same or falls? Don't we need to be honest enough to say that, yes, drug usage is likely to increase, but we have to weigh that against the many other benefits that come from it?
Well, that's a very good question. It's really the fundamental question in the legalization prohibition debate. I think that all of the major illegal drugs, which I would include marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, as more or less the natural side of the illegal drug market, I think that there would be definitely an increase in the demand and consumption of those products. There's really little question in my mind that there would be an increase. However, there are instances, and simultaneously, I think there would be a decrease in the use of things like crystal meth and some of these newly concocted chemical combinations that are coming out of China and Southeast Asia that are killing people. I think that there will be a decrease in demand for those things. And basically, there are products that if the price were to rise or to fall significantly, there wouldn't be any change in consumption. And insulin is probably the best example of this. People wouldn't change their dosages based on price. They would, if the price went up 500% or went down 90%, they would still consume the same amount. But the thing about my research is that I emphasize the fact that price changes, yes, that's usually the most important thing when an economist talks about a market. But in this case, it's going from a prohibited black market to a free market where there's property rights, there's a legal system, there's a rule of law, there's commercialization. And so that what I've argued is that by going from a prohibited market to a legal market framework, that yes, the quantity would increase, but the safety would also increase dramatically. Information would increase dramatically. All of a sudden, suppliers wouldn't want to be necessarily killing their consumers because they'd face lawsuits and all sorts of things besides their reputation effect. And so you really have to look at things in an entirely different framework. And when we went from alcohol prohibition in the 1920s to legalizing alcohol in the 1930s, yes, there was some increase in consumption, mainly as people went from whiskey to back to beer and wine. But there was all sorts of other great things, like the murder rate fell by 50%. The violent crimes declined by almost 50%. Government budgets could be cut, and tax revenues could be raised. And, you know, back in before alcohol prohibition, alcohol taxes were one of the biggest funding sources for government. And, of course, we're not arguing for funding sources for government, but You know, it allowed school, when they legalized alcohol in 33, the revenues to local, county, city, state, and federal governments allowed things like schools to stay open. So it causes, you know, the effect of prohibition is pervasive throughout society, and so, and it's all negative. And so when you remove that prohibition and you reestablish legal markets, you create all sorts of new centers of progress and prosperity. And of course, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana all have legitimate commercial medical uses. And we're learning all sorts of new things about the potential for marijuana, for hemp in medicine, and hemp in textiles, and all sorts of other areas in the economy. So I see medical marijuana and legalization of drugs altogether as a very beneficial thing, and I don't see things like heroin addiction and the really severe social problems that it causes, you know, spiraling out of control, basically. I think what we have in today's world is not just heroin, but it's crystal meth and all of these chemicals that are coming in from overseas where they tweak the molecules in these narcotic drugs and then produce them on a massive scale, and they bring them into the country, and they're not technically illegal until they change the law, until they write new legislation. And so our shores are being invaded by all this, these poisonous chemicals that just happen to get you high and sedated. So we've got to find some way to address these problems, and legalization is the only thing that systematically addresses these problems in a positive, sustained way.
Can you explain, maybe it's obvious, but it's not 100% obvious to me and might not be to the listeners, why exactly do you think that the use of drugs like the one you're just describing now would decline? Like, what's the thinking behind it? Like, what's the process by which that would decline?
Well, if you give people opportunities to consume safer, legal drugs, there are going to be a mass exodus from the illegal, you know, very dangerous, or let's say they're legal as well, but they're very dangerous products. You know, people are going to switch to the safer products. And for example, we've got a living example here in the United States where alcohol is perfectly legal and marijuana is illegal. And there's a ton of problems associated with alcohol consumption, drunken driving, spousal abuse, weight gain, you know, liver damage, all this stuff. And in areas where marijuana has been legalized, there's been a substitution effect from alcohol into marijuana. And we've been able to observe the impact of some of this stuff. For example, in decriminalized states, we've noticed that there's a significant drop in alcohol-related fatalities, or just fatalities on the road, because as people switch from alcohol to marijuana, they have fewer car accidents as a result. And so there's a natural tendency in human beings to want to consume the cheaper, safer, you know, more product that there's more experience with. And we have 5,000 years of experience of using marijuana and cannabis in its various forms.
Mark, I want to shift gears for a minute because I want to talk about a really short video that you put out late last week on the subject of health care, and it's part of this Mises View series of videos that's been going on for some months now. This is a great idea, long time coming, where people at the Mises Institute make brief videos about issues of current importance. And your video is called The Collapse of America's Healthcare Industry, and you're able to discuss this in 2 minutes and 44 seconds. Can you give us the let's see if you could do 2 minutes and 44 seconds, maybe you could do a minute and a half. Let's see, what's the thesis of that video?
Well, you know, I haven't written anything about Obamacare, and I haven't recorded anything or given any public lectures on Obamacare, and hadn't planned to, because, you know, scholars from the Mises Institute and Austrian economics have been you know, doing a very good job with this since before Obamacare even came up. We've been complaining about the American healthcare system and the Canadian healthcare system. And then this past week I was talking with a friend who was a big critic of Obamacare, and she's about 50 years old and she's semi-retired. She works a little bit on part-time jobs, and she had a catastrophic health care coverage, which only covers, you know, heart attacks and cancers and car wrecks and stuff like that. Doesn't cover drugs and testing and things of that nature. And that's the type of insurance, health care insurance, that Austrians recommend is rational on a free market. And her health care company called her, said it was your plan was canceled by Obamacare. You're going to have to get comprehensive health care coverage, which covers drugs and doctor's visits and testing and all the rest, plus cancer, heart attacks, and car accidents. And that's going to cost, instead of $300 a month, it's going to cost almost $1,200 a month to get a private policy. Well, that's, you know, she barely makes $1,200 a month, and so she was really worried. And a friend of her got her to get into a Obamacare exchange, where the government sort of processes your health care. You get Blue Cross Blue Shield, gold-plated comprehensive plan, and your total bill, ma'am, is $1.75 a month, okay? $1.75 a month instead of almost $1,200 a month. So obviously Obamacare is creating an incredible cross-subsidization from young people to old people, from healthy people to sick people, and from high-wage value-producing workers to low-wage value-producing workers. And so this is just, you know, another layer of government intervention ladled on to the existing American healthcare system, which is burdened with so much government intervention at every level. For doctors and hospitals and drug companies, they've all got monopolies. They're all heavily regulated, and they're falling apart. And Obamacare is just one extra layer on that crazy system, which is causing so much chaos in American healthcare. And we know that's the case because government's involved in giving monopolies and subsidies and insurance and all this sort of stuff for healthcare. But when we look at veterinarian care or plastic surgery or dental care, where most people have to pay, you know, out of pocket for their services, and they know what price they have to pay for caps or, you know, drillings in your teeth or shots for your dog or, you know, a nose job at the plastic surgeon, you know the price, you pay the cash, and there's no chaos, there's no waiting in line, there's no people going without and so forth. And so Americans, they need to look at the difference between their vets and their dentists and their plastic surgeon compared to their doctors and their hospitals, where government has invaded and taken over, and now Obama is just one more step on the road to complete chaos in American healthcare, and, you know, what Mises called German-style socialism, where one set of interventions leads to another, which needs remedial interventions, which causes additional problems, which cause increases in government intervention into the economy until the whole system basically collapses of its own weight.
Mark, before I let you go, I want you to take a minute to tell people about this event that the Mises Institute is putting on April 11th about inflation. It's billed as being for high school and homeschool students, but I think anybody can attend. And if you don't live in Auburn, Alabama, or thereabouts, you can attend virtually by watching online. So this is relevant to all my listeners. Can you just say something about that event? What can people expect to learn there?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have four lectures on inflation, and they're short, quick lectures, and we're going to give you all the basics and alert you to all the potential problems that the central bank can cause. And so that's going to be a great event. You can watch it online. It's free for anybody to come here to the Institute or to watch it online. And then don't forget, Tom, we've got the Austrian Economics Research Conference March 20th through the 22nd. Which is going to be great. We've got Judge Napolitano and the Wall Street wizard James Grant is going to be here. We're going to be celebrating the history of the Austrian school. And that's something also you can pay and come here to the Institute and get the full effect, or you can go online and watch the main lectures from the comfort of your living room.
Oh, but Mark, you're breaking my heart here, because this is the first year in years that I can't attend. Of course, for a good reason. We have a new baby coming, and I have to stick around the house. But, oh my gosh, it's people I get to see once a year. And now it's going to be once, you know, every 2 years, at least for this time around. But I'm sure it'll be great. I'm going to miss the judge, but I hope to see him this summer. I guess he's coming back to Mises University?
Oh, yes. He had a great time last year, and he said he wouldn't miss it for the world.
Fantastic. So students who are lucky enough to be admitted to your week-long summer program at the Mises Institute are going to get a chance to study directly under Judge Napolitano, who, by the way, you know, I think people think he gives a good speech and he's a good TV commentator. They have no idea what a great law professor he is. I mean, I was just blown away by his presence in the classroom. What an opportunity those kids had. When is the cutoff point for applications for Mises U? Do you know offhand?
I do not know offhand, but try to get your go to the scholarship page of the Mises Institute, Mises.org. All the events are listed on the event page. And just get your application in as soon as possible. We had a huge number of applications last year. We had over 600 people watching it online, so the demand for this program is great, but we're out there to get the next generation of American college students and foreign college students initiated into the Austrian school, and the Mises University is the flagship program for that process.
Oh, yeah. I went through it myself over 20 years ago, and I wouldn't change a thing. It was absolutely great. Well, Mark, I want to make sure everybody knows that the website is Mises.org. That's Mises.org. The events page is Mises.org/events. Mark, I appreciate your time today. I mean, I know it was a bit of a, we were sort of jumping around on topics, but if you would just stop writing so many things, I wouldn't be tempted to do that. But it was really great talking to you. We'll have you on again.
Likewise, Tom. Great.
Thanks, Mark. All right, everybody, a couple quick reminders. Of course, subscribe to the program on iTunes. Head over to TomWoodsRadio.com. You'll see right there in the description of the show an easy link to subscribe on iTunes. Be one of the cool people. All the cool people are subscribing to this program. Also, remember, you can help us stay on the air at no cost to yourself by entering Amazon through our Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. Then finally, my events coming up. A lot of exciting events going on coming up soon. March 15th, I'll be in Conway, Arkansas, at the University of Central Arkansas. April 9th, I'll be at Florida Southern College. April 10th, I'll be at Liberty University. And on May 9th, I'll be in Provo, Utah, for a special event there. Check out the details on these events at TomWoods.com. And I am hoping to have a Boston area event in late May or early June. The wheels will be turning on that one relatively soon. We'll see if we can make that baby work. All right, everybody, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.